It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday, and the Wisconsin foodie guys are joining us to talk about fall comfort foods.
First, though, new census data is out, and it places Milwaukee as one of the most impoverished big cities in the country, with nearly a third of the city living in poverty in 2012.
Some people respond thinking it's a Milwaukee problem, but Mayor Tom Barrett disagrees. He says it's a regional problem that needs a regional solution. He's here with us now to talk about why that is. Mayor Barrett, welcome to the show.
It's great to be joining you.
What do you make of the new census numbers about poverty in Milwaukee and the area?
Well, sadly, it's not shocking, and it shows why we have committed ourselves in the last 9 years to a very proactive approach in working with the private sector to create jobs near neighborhoods where they're needed most. Neighborhoods like the Menominee Valley, our Reed Street Yards, which is on the near south side, and the 30th Street Industrial Quarter, because we have lost a lot of jobs. And in the manufacturing downturn of the 80s and 90s, we lost many jobs. And, of course, in the Great Recession, those citizens and residents who had the lowest incomes were hit the hardest. So we understand that because of housing patterns, because of transportation patterns, because of employment patterns, that the majority of low-income people in southeastern Wisconsin are located within the city of Milwaukee, we've got some special challenges.
You call it a regional problem. Why is that?
Well, what was interesting is if you look at this data and other data that's just come out that's similar in nature, the city of Milwaukee has approximately 29.5% of its residents living in poverty, which puts us as the city with the ninth highest percentage of people living in poverty. In sharp contrast, if you look at our suburban friends, they've got the third lowest percentage of people living in poverty. And even more striking, and I just saw an analysis that did this, if you do the ratios, if you compare the two ratios, southeastern Wisconsin, the Milwaukee metropolitan area, is the only area where that factor is greater than four. In other words, what we have here is we have huge economic segregation that's occurring in this metropolitan area with low-income people located substantially and significantly in the central city, in the city proper itself. And we can draw lines and we can have different borders, but the fact is that this is something that has an impact on the entire region.
What kind of solutions would you like to see at a regional level to tackle poverty in Milwaukee?
Well, again, I just want your listeners to know that at the city level, we are extremely proactive. I think that's the first place it has to be. And I've already mentioned the Menominee Valley, the Reed Street Yards, the 30th Street Industrial Quarter. But there are other places where we're working at the city level. We're working to reduce teen pregnancy. We're working to do what we can for job readiness through workforce development. And obviously, we're working to have safer neighborhoods. That has an impact on this as well. However, with the housing patterns that you have in southeastern Wisconsin, with the lack of public transportation to jobs that are located outside of Milwaukee County, I don't think that these numbers are shocking. And when I say they're not shocking, they're shocking in the sense that they're the worst numbers in the country in terms of this economic segregation. But I don't see how people can be surprised because the strategy of separating low-income people from middle-income and upper-income people has been a strategy that's been in place for decades here.
There are probably people listening in the suburban area around Milwaukee or beyond thinking, why is this my problem? We're doing okay here. Why should I worry about lower-income people over in Milwaukee? How would you make that case to them?
Well, frankly, I could make the same case if I weren't the mayor in the neighborhood that I live in. I live in a nice middle-class neighborhood, and I could say, well, this isn't my problem. These are poor people who live on the other side of the park or on the other side of the tracks or on the other side of the county divide. And we can always find ways to separate each other. But the strength of this region is going to be dependent, I think, in the long run, based on not only how well the wealthiest people do, but how well middle-class people do and how well low-income people do. And we're seeing signs of this nationally, because nationally what you're seeing is you're seeing over the last 10 years in the 50 largest metropolitan areas in the country, the share of the population increase was about 10% in the cities, but the share of people living below the poverty level raised about 25%. So cities are increasingly asked to bear this social burden. And again, you do not want to create a situation where your central business area, your central city, and when I say central city, I mean the city proper, bears this load. And that's why we've been saying, look, of course we should have highway construction, but you have to have mass transit alternatives. Of course there should be housing development, but you have to have workforce housing close to the where the workforce needs to be, particularly in those areas where there's not mass transit. If we don't do that, I think that's going to hamper this region economically.
Isn't one of the obstacles that if somebody in one of these low-income areas does okay, they make money, they get a good job, one of the first things they want to do is to move into a middle-class area, whether within the city or one of the suburbs? How do you contest that kind of maybe natural urge?
Well, that's the American way, and I don't argue with that. I think that that's something that people obviously are interested in doing. And I think everybody wants to keep up with the Joneses, and everybody wants to get ahead of the Joneses. But as a region, we have to be mindful of the challenges that occur here. And again, government policies, real estate policies, lending policies have led to a situation where the majority of people who are low income are concentrated in a geographic area that puts tremendous stresses on other aspects of this metropolitan area. So we talk about regional assets all the time, but seldom do we hear people talk about regional responsibilities. And to me, those are flip sides of the same record album.
One solution you mentioned was the idea of better regional public transportation. That can be a tall order politically. There have been regional transportation associations brought up and shot down around the state. Do you think something like that can happen where you and your neighbors work together and build up a regional public transit system?
Well, look, I wasn't born on a turnip truck, and not only is this difficult, I realize that a lot of political hay can be made in opposing public transportation, particularly opposing public transportation that gets low-income workers out of low-income neighborhoods into other parts of this metropolitan area. I know that politically that people have staked their career on making sure that that doesn't happen. The question is that the right thing? I don't think it is.
And then you mentioned the decline in manufacturing jobs, and it seems like the economic climate is such that they're not going to come back and be the main solution. What kind of sectors do you see driving recovery in Milwaukee and the region and maybe giving jobs to the people, that 29% of people in Milwaukee living in poverty?
Well, I don't sell manufacturing short. Certainly this isn't 1950 or 1960, but we still have a relatively high percentage of people who work in the manufacturing sector when we compare it to other regions in the country. So that is still a significant area, I think, for potential growth for jobs. And that's why I've created my Mayor's Manufacturing Initiative, because one of the challenges and one of the frustrations I've encountered is people who go through a training program and then there's no job. And then I talk to employers who hire people from a training program and they say, well, they're not qualified to do the jobs that they have. So what we've worked to do, working through our workforce development agency and the technical college, is to cut out the middleman. In other words, what we've done is we found employers who have actual jobs and said, look, we will get the people, we will help pay for the training for those specific jobs. In exchange, you hire them. Cuts out the middleman. They know they're getting people who are getting trained, and they're getting trained for real-world jobs. The people going through the programs know that at the end of this tunnel, there's going to be light. There is going to be a job. And so it's not like a training program where they feel like they've gotten a diploma at the end, but there's no job. We're trying to actually match the jobs up with the people. And we have found that that has been more successful.
Is it frustrating, in closing, to be the mayor of Milwaukee and see it show up time after time on the list of among the more poverty-stricken nations in the country?
Well, I love being the mayor of Milwaukee, but it certainly is frustrating to see what I perceive as a problem that we could address more readily if there was more cooperation and if there was more of an understanding that this isn't the problem that lies on one side of the tracks or the other side of the tracks, that we're all in this together.
Mayor Barrett, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you very much.
That was Tom Barrett, Mayor of Milwaukee.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll be back with the Wisconsin Foodie Guides to talk about fall comfort foods. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Well, the weather's starting to turn a bit colder around Wisconsin, which means one thing in that kitchen, comfort food.
For our Food Friday segment this week, we're talking to the guys from Wisconsin Foodie about their favorite mac and cheese recipes and some other comfort foods to help us forget about the impending doom of winter.
Joining us now are Arthur Ersing, creator and executive producer of Wisconsin Foodie, and Kyle Cherik, host of Wisconsin Foodie. Hi, guys.
Hello.
So you guys have mac and cheese on your minds. Kyle, tell us what's got you thinking about macaroni and cheese right now.
Oh, well, judging this contest that's coming up, the so I guess sort of a smackdown where a myriad of local chefs get to come in with literally no boundaries, as I was reading, and we're going to sample out some mac and cheese and declare the best presented that day. And so I've been holding off on it for about a week, which is hard to do, but you know, you want to have a clean palate or something like that, because you never know what the onslaught's going to be.
Oh, I know. And Arthur, you know, what is it about macaroni and cheese, do you think, that makes it such good comfort food, especially now that it's getting a little nippy?
Well, I think, you know, you got to look at the cheese. You got to look at the, you know, just that kind of that texture, the melty, the hearty. It's just like reminds us of our childhood and of home and, you know, where else would you rather be on a nice, cool fall day than sitting at home eating some mac and cheese?
The nice thing about mac and cheese is that it's one of these dishes that you can really put your own stamp on. It's sort of a blank slate. You need the noodles. You probably need some kind of cheese, although I've seen vegan versions of it. But beyond that, you can get really kind of creative with it. Kyle, what have you seen done with mac and cheese that gets it kind of jiggy?
Well, my favorite, you know, sort of mac and cheese take me back moment, I actually had the dish. I don't want to disclose where, but it took me back to this great rosemary mac and cheese that the Social, when it was still open here in Milwaukee, this tiny place, and the chef who had trained under Sanford D'Amato, Chris Atali, made it right there in front of you because it was this super small place. You sat at what was originally the bar, and he grilled it and finished it off right in front of you, and it had this terrific, amazing herbal, slightly smoky, creamy, perfect every time. It was the most sublime mac and cheese I'd ever had to that point in my entire life. And he made it from scratch with the exception of the pasta right there in front of you. And so I guess in my heart and on my palate, I kind of dare anybody whenever they say, oh, I've got great mac and cheese, to get that good, to come to that level.
You will see on September 29th with this, the mac and cheese takedown, because I think you'll be sampling over 50 different mac and cheeses. So that may you may find a better mac and cheese out there.
Yeah, use the word sublime. The bar is pretty high there for that one.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, a great dish is a great dish. I don't know. What more? We like to write and think about these things, but sometimes it's those opening notes of think of a great Gershwin melody or something like that, where you know it instantly, and more notes or less notes would be too many or not enough. It's just perfect.
So it seems like in general there are two ways you can do mac and cheese, you know, besides all of the variations, but you can do it the saucy way, where it's sort of like your craft, but, you know, you don't have to bake it. And then there's the baked kind.
That's not mac and cheese. I'm sorry.
You're drawing the line right there.
Yeah, that and vegan mac and cheese. I mean, God bless anybody that wants to pursue the lifestyle of being a vegan. I think it's great, but that's not mac and cheese.
Well, do you have a preference as far as baked versus the saucy kind?
Well, naturally saucy. It goes with my personality. Arthur's the real cheese aficionado, though. I want to hear him.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's talk about cheeses, because that's obviously, you know, the first thing you need in a good mac and cheese. Arthur, what do you prefer when it comes to cheeses and mac and cheese?
Well, I think we're pretty blessed here in Wisconsin with having, you know, just the kind of variety and abundance of amazing world quality cheeses right in our back door. So there's one mac and cheese recipe that we had on our show years and years ago with Tori Miller was on, and he was a fresh faced Mohawked younger gentleman, and he was cooking on our show, and he created a double cut pork chop with a mac and cheese, and the mac and cheese was, you know, basically these large shells, and he reduced white wine, and he used you know, almost a whole pack of the cold pack cheese, and then shredded some Carvalho Mammoth cheddar, as well as some Blue Mont Dairy bandage cheddar into the mac and cheese. Now that, like, you know, not everybody, there's nobody in the world that can mimic that those types of cheeses in this mac and cheese. And that makes that dish one of my favorite mac and cheeses out there. And we have, you know, what I'm going to do is I went back into our vault of videos and I found the video and I'm going to post it on the front page of our website. So if people are interested in seeing how he makes his mac and cheese, they can check that recipe out on our website.
That's so interesting.
If I had could try that, that might usurp the old social mac and cheese, but I wasn't lucky enough to have that. I'll have to talk to Tori about that.
But instead of baking it, you know, it's kind of saucy. Instead of baking it, though, he throws some toasted panko breadcrumbs on the top, so it has that kind of crunchy, you know, texture to it.
I like that he added the cold-packed cheese with these very high-end cheeses, bandage cheddar and mammoth cheddar.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really a mixture of things. So what did that do to the taste? I'm curious.
Oh, I mean, it's, you know, it's hard to explain. It's basically, you know, like eating happiness.
That doesn't sound bad at all.
It's curious how some of the most basic peasant dishes, for lack of a better term, can be innovated into something that's really, really dynamic at the hands of a great chef. You know, I mean, Kraft just brings it down way too many levels, but the original mac and cheese is a very simple dish. But then at the hands of Tori, he knows what to do with it. You take it to a different level, but it's still a peasant dish, essentially.
Well, so now is the time of year when root veggies are starting to be more abundant, things like squash. Do you think those lend themselves well to mac and cheese, Kyle?
I do. They're kind of, for me, it's a textural thing. I mean, I'm a big roaster of all of those root vegetables and the squashes and things like that. Basically, that takes over for all the green things that are so abundant from our garden in the summer. But I probably wouldn't put the two next to each other, essentially. If I was doing mac and cheese at home, we'll do a protein or something a little bit more rustic to stand up against that creaminess.
Such as? Like a bacon or
ham? Well, no, I would. Everyone that's been following me lately knows that I'm huge on lamb and or a pork roast. Or a great lamb chop, pork chop cut, or a lamb chop. And, you know, the thing about fall cooking that I always have to guard against is having something, this sounds funny, but that I can really chew, because between the mac and cheeses and the amazing stews and all of those things that you roast to get all the goodness and so forth out of them, it softens them down like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So I find myself by November basically just craving some really crunchy bread.
So you want something with a little tooth in it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. One of my favorite things in the fall actually is this great dessert that George Washington, apparently I found online, really loved, which is using a pie pumpkin and scooping it out and then putting in a very simple custard recipe inside. And my sister-in-law actually made it for Thanksgiving a couple of years ago. And you put the whole thing in the oven for like 4 or 5 hours, and it slowly roasts and the two come together. And it is one of the most delicious, incredible. And then you just carve right into it and serve the custard out. It's so amazing.
Ah, that doesn't sound like, so you turn away at your dinner table. That sounds fantastic. I've had custards baked in the miniature pumpkins, and they're pretty great vessels just for that kind of thing, too. Well, as we get toward the end of our time together, what other fall comfort foods, Arthur, are you getting psyched about right now?
I'm just excited about, you know, this is, you know, being a vegetarian, this is like the glory time right now at the farmers markets. You have, you know, the tomatoes are there. Everything is, it's kind of just total abundance. So where I've been going lately, what I've been really trying to master is canning all this great food. You know, we take part in a CSA here in Springdale Farms. And we get, you know, a box of vegetables each week. And it's just, you know, I want to try to, you know, take all of that great fresh food and the stuff that I can't eat that whole week or my family can't eat, I'm trying to figure out how to preserve it. So I've been making tomato sauces, salsas, and, you know, just trying to keep that stuff. So in the middle of winter, I can, you know, still be eating delicious local food. That's, if not total fresh, it's pretty close.
And Kyle, in the last 30 seconds here, what about you? What are you looking forward to besides mac and cheese?
Oh, that's so hard. I can't get the menu flips that happen. I totally agree with Arthur. Any chef can cook fabulous things during the summer, some salt and butter, and great things are coming out of the ground. In fall, when the menu flips happen and the vegetables change and the proteins really come into their own, I basically do food tourism in a different way around the state, because what that's, I think that, and in spring is when the chefs get most creative, and it's just exciting to have some of their dishes.
Well, Kyle, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happily.
And Arthur, good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
We were talking to Arthur Ersin, creator and executive producer of Wisconsin Foodie, and Kyle Cherik, the host of Wisconsin Foodie.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll talk about how scarcity and the way we respond to it shapes our lives, our society, and our culture.
We'll also talk about the history of what's often called the most important meal of the day, breakfast.
And we'll talk about how a lot of us can be citizen scientists. We can help wildlife experts keep track of animal populations around Wisconsin.
That's all coming up Monday, right here on Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a look at new carbon limits from the Environmental Protection Agency and what that means for coal power plants.
First, a new effort aims to bring war veterans into the world of organic farming.
The Farmer Veteran Coalition is holding an event tomorrow in Verona. We posted a link with information on the Central Time Facebook page.
Ryan Ayersman joins us now in the studio. He's Midwest Coordinator for the Farmer Veteran Coalition. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Rob, thank you. It's good to be here.
How did this get started? Who had the idea of trying to get vets set up into the organic farming world?
So in 2008, Michael O'Gorman, an organic vegetable farmer in Baja, California, started the Farmer Veteran Coalition. O'Gorman was a 1970s back-to-the-lander who had protested the Vietnam War. But after September 11th, Michael O'Gorman's son joined the Coast Guard and eventually served 2 one-year deployments. So that made him think differently about veterans and the kind of people that would serve in war. The second impetus was the 2006 O'Hare report from the Carsey Institute at the University of New Hampshire. And this was the first study that really made the connection that a disproportionate number of military personnel serving in Iraq and Afghanistan had come from rural areas. And so O'Gorman began the Farmer Veteran Coalition really in response to those events and to solve two converging trends in America. One, that the average American farmer is 58 years old and that two people leave farming for every one who enters. And the other, that no matter what our current unemployment rate is in America, veterans seem to always have a consistently higher rate of unemployment. So he was really trying to solve those problems all at once with the Farmer Veteran Coalition.
And Ryan, this is a natural fit for you. We were just talking, you're a veteran yourself, a Marine veteran, and you grew up on a farm. It's a natural for you, right?
It is. Actually, there was a New York Times article a few years ago about the Farmer Veteran Coalition, and when it came out, about five of my friends emailed it to me simultaneously. So I emailed Michael O'Gorman and said, this is who I am. This is my background. I grew up on an organic farm in Illinois, served 10 years in the Marine Corps as an infantry officer. And I said, I don't need anything, but I'd like to help if you're ever interested in coming out to the Midwest. And the next year, I brought him out to the MOSES, Midwest Organic and Sustainable Education Services Conference in La Crosse. And so we've brought veterans out to MOSES 2 years in a row now, and we'll continue to do that.
And are you seeing people who join the program, are they mostly people who grew up on a farm, or do you get some new people who have never lived the farm life before?
We get both. We get veterans who are returning to family farms, veterans who have been injured, sometimes single, double amputees who are returning to farms and need some assistance through AgriBility and other programs to make their farms accessible for their needs. But we also get a lot of veterans who want to come to farming and have no background in it. But that's not unique to veterans. I think we're seeing that trend in America in general with this generation under 30. And maybe this is an echo boom of that back-to-the-land movement.
I sometimes think when I'm working in my tiny garden, like, oh, it'd be a lot of fun to have a farm. And then I think about all the work and my ineptitude at that sort of thing. What kind of training do you give to the veterans who are coming who didn't grow up on a farm, don't know necessarily what they're getting into?
So the Farmer Veteran Coalition provides tours, educational workshops, and retreats to veterans at various farms and places throughout the country. We've probably done that for about 400 veterans in the last 4 years. Additionally, we also provide fellowship funds, and to date, we've probably provided almost $300,000 since April of 2011 to 50 veterans across 25 states to help them purchase equipment and Additionally, we also point the disabled veterans towards state agribility programs, again, to help them make their farm accessible to their needs. But a lot of the educational piece is both those workshops and then the natural networking that happens when you bring people with a common background and a common interest together. So we get the ball rolling when we show them different farm tours, but then a lot of it takes care of itself from there.
How about connecting them with land? Do you work on trying to get veterans who want to be farmers, some farmland?
We do, and that's probably the biggest challenge for a beginning farmer, whether you're a veteran or not, is accessibility to land. Specifically, we try to partner veterans with an experienced farmer to help them along, and in some cases, that experienced farmer becomes the farmer who ends up letting the veteran take over the lease to that farm and begin integrating into that operation. That's not common, but it has been one of the great success stories of what we've done. But access to land, like I said, is an issue for any beginning farmer, and so we've partnered with other organizations such as right here in Madison, the Farley Center, and they have their own land link program that people can look up and contact, whether they're landowners interested in leasing land to a beginning farmer, veteran or not, and especially for beginning farmers who are looking for land.
Not everybody is cut out for farming, not every veteran, I'm sure, but is there something, do you think, about organic farming that is going to be special for a veteran, helpful, help them make the transition back to civilian life?
Well, first of all, the Farmer Veteran Coalition doesn't specifically support one type of farming over another. We actually support the veteran's right to farm as he or she sees fit with what best fits their circumstances. So many of those veterans that are returning to family operations are taking over whatever system that their parents had in place. But for a beginning farmer with minimal capital and limited access to land, something like small-scale organic production provides a lot of opportunity because it's low overhead. Now, that's not to say that it's easy. It is very difficult. It's labor-intensive. Mm-hmm. It's management-intensive. And it's a lot of education to understand how to produce and market and sell that crop successfully in that short season. But it is probably the easiest thing to get into if you didn't grow up on a farm and don't have access to those resources.
Do you think veterans bring any kind of unique skill set or mindset that gives them an advantage when they start off as farmers?
Absolutely. Veterans, you can pretty much bet, know how to handle adversity. They've certainly experienced various levels of difficult problem solving. And for a few, I think, perhaps their own combat experience of understanding the fragility of life, they embrace the opportunity to nurture crops and animals with a very strong enthusiasm.
You've got an event in the area tomorrow. What's going on? What would people see if they went there?
So our event tomorrow is at the Farley Center in Verona, and the Farley Center is an incubator farm. So that's a farm that helps beginning farmers by offering them small plots of land to begin cultivating, in this case, vegetable crops. So what people will see tomorrow is they'll see 9 acres at the Farley Center in cultivation by current farmers that are working there. They'll get to tour those operations. They'll get to talk to a couple farmers that are there and see what that's like to run something that's a small-scale organic CSA. And of course, the more veterans that show up, the more opportunity we have to network and exchange ideas. And it's for veterans, but any beginning farmer is welcome. We want people to understand that we support veterans, but we support all beginning farmers because we need as many hands in the field as we can get.
We put a link to the Farley Center on the Central Time Facebook page. So suppose there's a veteran out there of the, say, Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, listening, thinking, I never thought about this before. I could see that as a way of life. Maybe I should check it out. Can you give a little pep talk to at least explore and take that first step?
Sure. The first thing to do is, in Wisconsin, you can call me at 608-616-9768. That's 608-616-9768. But we can talk about farming, we can talk about the experience, and certainly the opportunity to see other young farmers and plug into our network, meet other veterans who have started their farms in the last few years and started successful businesses is a great way for a young vet to see himself or herself trying to fit into that same paradigm and be a successful farmer.
Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Ryan Erisman, Midwest Coordinator for the Farmer Veteran Coalition.
Coming up, a look at proposed new regulations on carbon emissions from the EPA. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Today, the Environmental Protection Agency released the first ever federal carbon limits on the nation's power companies.
Some are welcoming the change, saying it's needed to control global warming. Critics say it could cripple the nation's coal industry.
Vicki Patton joins us now. She's a general counsel at the Environmental Defense Fund. Vicki, thanks for joining us.
I very much appreciate the opportunity to do so.
Well, Vicki, can you catch us up on what the EPA announced today about carbon emissions?
Veronica, today the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency proposed long overdue limits on the carbon pollution that is discharged from new fossil fuel power plants. Our nation's power plants are the single largest source of carbon pollution in our country, and in fact, they churn out more carbon pollution than many nations standing alone. It's a big source of pollution, and there's a lot of good things we can do to strengthen our economy and address this problem.
And how big a deal would you say this is coming right now?
It's quite important. When you look across our country, we have been hard hit by the ravages of extreme weather, from Superstorm Sandy to my own part of the country here in Colorado, where we have just been suffering from very serious flooding to the lives that are disrupted from drought. The impacts of extreme weather on our lives, the lives lost, the lives disrupted, our economy, those costs are too high. And through smart, common sense, clean energy solutions, we can make some real progress in addressing this challenge and building a stronger clean energy economy.
Now, this is something that President Obama had promised some action on earlier when he was running. How did the limits today square with what he said he'd do before?
So the limits proposed today are very much in line with what the president laid out in his covenant with the nation in June. The good news is that in all parts of our country, red states and blue states alike, the winds of change are blowing. We are innovating, and we are delivering cost-effective electricity to America's families and businesses through clean energy in the heartland, in the Midwest, in places like Illinois and Iowa and Oklahoma and Kansas. Vast amounts of wind power are being deployed, and they're being sold on these big interstate transmission lines, and we're delivering cost-effective clean energy really across our country. And in 2012, the single largest source of new electricity in our nation, wind power. So there's just a lot of great innovation happening across our country, and these new clean air standards are going to help foster that innovation and protect the health and environment of our families and communities.
Now, President Obama mentioned some of the moves toward clean energy, and on the other end of the spectrum, you've got people who are worried about the coal industry saying that this is going to take away jobs, for instance, from Kentucky and the livelihood of people, and worried, there was a senator who called it a war on coal. What do you make of that?
The time-tested history of the nation's clean air laws, and it is a tremendous American innovation that we all should be incredibly proud of, is that we have confronted naysayers and obstructionists time and time again. You'll remember that when the nation was wrestling with whether to put in place catalytic converters in the automobiles a quarter century ago, there were some who said, it can't be done. We can't meet this challenge. Similarly, when people were looking at how do we address acid rain that was afflicting our forests and streams and lakes across the eastern United States, there were, you know, so many who stood up and said, you know, this can't be done. We don't have the technology. We can't do it. We just confronted a similar sort of situation when the nation was looking at finally controlling the mercury from coal-fired power plants. The same people who are right now saying that we could not reduce the toxic mercury from coal-fired power plants are saying that we can't reduce the carbon pollution from coal-fired power plants. They're wrong. We have proven time and time again that America can innovate, that we can meet big challenges, and what we'll do is we'll deliver incredibly important health and environmental benefits at a small fraction of the cost. And what we often find is that these technologies that we create and innovate in our own country, we end up selling overseas and strengthening our global competitiveness. So this is the time-tested history of the Clean Air Act, with lots of people saying, can't be done, can't solve this challenge, innovate, and we do, and we deliver big benefits for our families, our communities, and for our economy.
Now, to look at the brass tacks of it a little bit, can you explain what these new standards are compared to what the power plants are emitting currently?
So right now, typical coal-fired power plant would churn out anywhere between, say, 1,800 and 2,200 pounds of carbon pollution for kind of its every pound megawatt hour, every unit of electricity it produces. It's almost a ton of carbon pollution, and the standards that have been proposed today would reduce that by about 40%. And, these coal-fired power plants are currently completely uncontrolled for carbon pollution. And so when you look across our country, we have put in place important limits on the carbon pollution from our motor vehicles, from our cars. We've put in place important limits on our carbon pollution for the large diesel freight trucks that haul goods and wares across our highways, but we have not yet in any way cut the dangerous carbon pollution from coal-fired power plants. It's time that they do their fair share, and we're looking at an important first step through today's proposal. And I hope, Veronica, your listeners will weigh in support of these standards, because we need their support.
Now, with these new standards, when is it expected that companies will be compliant with them?
The nation's clean air laws expect companies to begin taking steps immediately to begin complying with these standards. There will be a round of public comment, and there will be lots of discussion, and people will weigh in with their views about the strengths and weaknesses of what the Environmental Protection Agency has proposed. And then the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency will take sort of final action and put in place final protections. Once those standards are finalized, that's when they're binding. That's when compliance is required. But it's smart business practice. It's good planning to begin, anticipating these standards and making smart investment decisions that cut the carbon pollution from power plants sooner rather than later.
Vicky, how big a battle are you anticipating on this? We have someone like the U.S. State Republican leader Mitch McConnell saying that he will do everything within his political power to bring it to a vote. And again, we've got these listening sessions coming up where the industry can weigh in as well. How contentious is this, do you think?
There are far too many inside the Beltway that kind of relish the tit for tat, the acrimony, the discord, the polarization. But outside the Beltway, Americans are hard hit by the extreme weather that impacts our lives and harms our economy. And Americans are also innovating and delivering clean energy solutions. And so I think there's a bit of a dissonance between those inside the Beltway who just business as usual, attack, criticize, But I think there's lots of tremendous innovation happening across America. What we found, Veronica, when the Environmental Protection Agency put in place climate pollution standards for clean cars, they were ultimately supported by the U.S. auto industry. They were supported by the United Auto Workers, by states across the country. And now what we're seeing is they're delivering cost savings to America's families, and cost savings at the gas pump, because for every mile that you drive, you can get further on a gallon of gasoline because they're far more efficient. They're helping to strengthen our energy security and our national security because we're using less oil, and they're reducing dangerous climate pollution. So we know how, as a country, when we roll up our sleeves and we find a way to work together and get past this discord, to put in place smart policies that deliver big and broad benefits for our nation.
As we've heard, the coal industry isn't going gently into this so far, at least from early indications. What is the EPA doing to incentivize manufacturers and other stakeholders to find other energy sources in the meantime?
Well, the coal industry is, in a misplaced, misguided way, blaming a lot of people for the shift that's happening across our country away from coal. But if you read the fine print, what you'll find is that the coal industry also acknowledges that it is just struggling to compete in the marketplace. So why they like to blame policies in Washington, D.C. For their problems, and why they like to blame, you know, really almost anyone they can. I was taking a look just recently at the filing before the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission by the chairman and president of Arch Coal. And in that filing, he said, we are having difficulty competing in the marketplace against other forms of electricity. So coal itself is acknowledging that it's really not Washington, D.C. policies. It's really not all of these other factors. It's that America is innovating and delivering lower-emitting, cleaner energy solutions, and coal is having a serious difficulty competing. And so it's really, I think, in the final analysis, a question for the coal industry. Are they going to continue to fight and obstruct? Or are they going to innovate and compete in the marketplace?
All right. Well, Vicki, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Vicki Patton, General Counsel at the Environmental Defense Fund.
Up next, we're joined by the cast of Cinematic Titanic, a live show by the creators of Mystery Science Theater 3000. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.